Hello, my name is Joe Schwartz, and I would like to take a moment to tell you about my podcast. It's called Still Unknown, and it's a podcast dealing exclusively with unsolved murders, disappearances, unexplained deaths, and other unsolved mysteries. If you are a fan of the classic TV show Unsolved Mysteries, then you'll definitely want to check out my podcast, as many episodes deal with cases featured on the show that still need answers. So look for Still Unknown on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this podcast here. And let's solve some mysteries together.
Welcome to Forensic Miles. My name is Miles.
Hey guys, it's Sean. Hope you're doing well.
Welcome back to everybody who has listened to before and to everybody who is new. Welcome. We're super excited to have you. Forensic Miles is the unofficial companion podcast to the cult favorite show, Forensic Files. You've seen the show. You know the crime. But is there more to the story? Usually there is a lot more to the story, but this one, the new things aren't really 100% verified. So I'm going to tell them to you, but take them with a grain of salt and kind of create your own feelings about this one. We'll tell you how we feel, but definitely make your own opinions. Because at the end of the day, you know, he's in jail, so, and he's serving his time. So we have to hope that the jury got it right.
All right, let's dig in and find out if they did.
So today we're going to be covering the Forensic Files episode, Fashion Police. And this is another name where I'm kind of like, what are you talking about? But it is the story of the murder of Julie Ann Braun. So I'm just going to get right into it. Julie Ann Braun was a 35-year-old mother of two, Nathan, who was 9, and Christian, who was 3 at the time. They lived in the Westwood apartment complex in West Central Fresno. Julie's ex-husband and the father of her two children, John Braun, and her had recently gotten a divorce. I'm not exactly sure when the divorce happened, whether it was, you know, a few years, a few months before this happened, but nonetheless, they were divorced. And during her apartment search, she was really focused on finding something that valued safety. And she settled upon the Westwood Apartments because, among other things, they had a secure gate around the complex, so you could only get in with a key. And, you know, I lived as a single woman, and it's scary, and you definitely want to make sure that wherever you find is a safe place, because she's going to be there alone with her kids, and when the kids are at the dad's house, she's going to be there alone. So she really felt secure with these Westwood apartments and really felt that she had made a good decision. She worked at the Fireside Thrift Company as a loan manager and helped people with financing options. She really loved to help people, almost to a fault. Her mother said in the Forensic Files episode that Julie would help anybody she could. If there was somebody walking down the road looking like they needed a ride, you know, to go and get gas or something, Julie would be the person that would pull over and help them. Her son described her as the nicest person in the world. So you can really get a picture of who Julie was. She was a very friendly, kind, and helpful person.
Yeah, I definitely would not just pick somebody up on the side of the road.
Yeah, I would not either. Unfortunately, all of her kindness that she gave out to the world could not save her from the evil that lay ahead. On Monday, August 2nd, 1999, Julie's mother, Mary Silva, received a call from Julie's employer. They said that she had not come in to work that day. This immediately set off alarms. It was not like Julie to just miss a day of work without calling in, and so her mother and Julie's father, Manuel, drove to the Westwood Apartments to check on their daughter. They called the apartment manager to open the door, and what they found was absolutely devastating. Manuel tried to push his wife back from the doorway, but it was too late. The scene that they had witnessed would be ingrained in their minds for the rest of their lives. Lying on the floor, in a pool of blood, was their daughter, Julie. Mary described the feeling of finding out that her daughter was dead as if somebody had taken a bit of her heart. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's devastating for a parent to walk in on their child like that.
Yeah. Police were called to the scene, and an investigation was soon underway. It appeared that the attack had been sexually motivated, as Julie was found in her undergarments. However, there was no sign of sexual assault or rape. They noticed that there was no sign of forced entry, which led investigators to believe that Julie knew her killer and willingly let them into the apartment. They also realized that the motive didn't appear to be robbery, as Julie's purse and jewelry were still in the home. The medical examiner determined that Julie had been victim to a brutal killing. It appeared that she had died the night before she was found, Sunday, August 1st. She had been stabbed 37 times.
Wow. Were the kids with the ex-husband, I guess?
Well, we'll get to it. But yes, the children were not home that day, and she was the only victim of this crime. They found a small kitchen knife in the sink, and it didn't have any signs of blood, but they did assume that it was the murder weapon. There were also footprints found. They weren't detailed enough to get an idea of what kind of shoes that the perpetrator had been wearing, but they did kind of give a general size outline. One of these footprints was found on Julie's body.
Oh, wow.
Which really goes to show who the person is. Like, this is somebody that has absolutely no respect for Julie's life, or human life for that matter. That was basically all the evidence they could find. There was like nothing else. There was no footprints. There was no other blood in the house other than Julie's, you know, what was found around her body. So investigators were kind of stumped, but they began to look for suspects. And in true crime junkie fashion, they immediately turned to her ex-husband, John.
Of course.
Of course. Divorces are always difficult, even if they are a mutual decision. And the idea that the husband did it didn't seem to be too outlandish, especially when they realized that John had done something a little bit strange on the night that Julie was killed. John had had the children earlier that day and was meant to bring them back to Julie's, but he didn't. And this was really weird because he always brought them home at the end of the day. He said that there had been some kind of change of plans and that he decided it was too late to bring them back to Julie's house. Now, being a kid of a family with two homes, I can understand this happening. I mean, sometimes you just go off and you do something and it's too late and you end up just staying at whatever parent's house. So it's you know, believable. But it was weird because he had never done it before. John was also a few months behind on child support payments, which, you know, kind of makes sense as a motive. I'm not sure what the cost of those payments were, and I'm not sure his financial state, but, you know, there is the possibility that that could be a motive. Investigators, you know, just initially felt off about him, and they were going to leave him as a suspect, especially because they knew that Julie would open the door for John.
Yeah.
She wouldn't even hesitate. As far as I know, there was no bad blood between them. I mean, the divorce was mutual and they were both moving on.
Well, especially if she was expecting the kids to be there with him.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's when another suspect kind of came into view. John's new girlfriend, Brenda, a 32-year-old school teacher. They were really starting to get hot and heavy, and things were really kind of becoming serious between the two of them. Brenda was obviously somebody else that Julie would absolutely open the door for, especially if she had the kids.
Right.
Investigators knew that there was a possibility that the killer was a woman, especially because there wasn't a rape. There was nothing in the murder that said that a woman couldn't have done it. It turns out that Julie, Brenda, and John had recently gotten into an argument that got a little bit out of hand. Brenda accused Julie of trying to get back together with John. There is no evidence that this was true, and I think, you know, the argument kind of just faded away. However, it did happen a couple days before Julie's murder. And then another lead came forward. The apartment manager went to police with a very interesting story. The manager's wife had been walking the grounds during her nightly rounds when a new tenant, a man by the name of Jeremy Ryan Overstreet, approached her. Overstreet told her that the window in his apartment was broken and he needed her to come look at it immediately. He tried to lead her down an extremely dark, secluded area of the apartments, but something didn't feel right to her. Overstreet was really pushy and she just didn't feel comfortable, so she declined. The next morning, she went over to the apartment to check on the windows and discovered that nothing was broken and everything was 100% okay.
Yeah, that's pretty odd. That would raise some flags for me.
Absolutely. I think any time that somebody is trying to pressure you into doing something that you don't feel comfortable with, it's always a good idea just to say no. You know, you better be safe than sorry. And in this case, I think she was extremely lucky.
I mean, for her too, like, in my head, if I was in her position, I would be wondering why he's coming to me and not, like, the maintenance, somebody from maintenance to fix the window.
Exactly.
I get that she's, you know, the property manager, but at the end of the day, it's got to be
somebody. She's the manager's wife.
Oh, so yeah, it's got to be somebody from maintenance who would even be able to help him anyways if there was something wrong with the window.
And yeah, and it's not like she would be able to fix it that night anyway. I mean, we're talking about late at night.
Yeah.
But, believe it or not, this wasn't the first time something like this had happened in the apartment complex with Overstreet. Another woman came forward mentioning that Overstreet had come to her apartment asking to borrow sugar, but he didn't have anything to put the sugar in. It immediately didn't feel right to her, so she pushed him out of her apartment. I mean, this happening twice before with two different women. Just strange sort of...
It's a weird pattern.
Things. I mean, it doesn't automatically mean that he is the killer, but this is weird. I would say that I...
It's definitely showing some questionable...
motives.
Yeah.
And it gets worse. Investigators knew that they had to talk to Overstreet, but when they went to find him, they discovered that he had disappeared and was on the run. They did a background check on him and discovered some interesting information. In 1995, Overstreet had raped a woman in the backyard of an abandoned house. He was convicted of this attack and was sentenced to prison in Orange County. During the attack, he told the woman, basically, either you have sex with me or I'm gonna kill you.
Wow.
Yeah. In 1999, he was released on parole and was expected to check in with his parole officer and register on the sex offender registry. Overstreet did neither of these. In fact, he ran to Fresno.
Where did you say the original?
Orange County. Mm-hmm.
Where is that compared to... That's the same state, though. Still in California.
Yeah, it's both in California. I'm not 100% sure how far away they are from each other. But it was absolutely against his parole for him to go to Fresno. He soon met an exotic dancer by the name of Holly. I'm not 100% sure that her real name is Holly, but that is the name that they used for her in the Forensic Files episode. And they met at a club where she worked. In the Forensic Files episode, they mentioned that Holly described Jeremy as a, quote, articulate and attractive man, and feeling sorry for him, since he was unemployed, she invited him to live with her and a relationship soon began.
I have a feeling Holly didn't know the true background there.
Probably not. Holly said that on the morning the body was discovered, Overstreet ran off. This could clearly show his guilt, but remember, Overstreet had violated his parole, and as soon as an officer identified him, he would be headed right back to prison. So it does kind of make sense that he would run for either of those issues, whether he's guilty or, you know,
just a parole violation.
Just the parole violation. It makes sense that he would run when he realized tons of police officers were surrounding his apartment complex.
Yeah.
Holly mentioned that on the night Julie was murdered, Overstreet was home and she hadn't noticed any blood on him. But friends that were at her apartment that night mentioned that his behavior was a little bit off. When friends were over, he would typically sit down, hang out, and drink with them for a bit, but not on this night. On the night of August 1st, Overstreet came home and made a beeline for his room. He even specifically stated that he wished not to be disturbed.
That's weird.
It is a little bit weird. I mean, and I know, like, if you come home tired from work or something and you don't want to hang out with friends, like, whatever. But this felt different to them. Investigators knew that they needed more evidence for a conviction and to know for sure which suspect was the true killer. They went back to the crime scene and they found something that they hadn't seen before. A tiny shirt button with blood on it. And also the words Eddie Bauer. Eddie Bauer is like a clothing brand. Investigators reached out to Eddie Bauer Company and asked what shirt this particular button could have come from. Eddie Bauer said that it could have come from a lot of shirts, both men and women's, but obviously it had to be like a button down.
Right.
They knew for a fact that the button didn't match any of Julie's clothes. As they had searched her closets, they knew what she had been wearing. It absolutely did not come from anything that she had in her home. And they also knew that the button was torn off the shirt, meaning it had to have come off from the struggle, not just, you know, absentmindedly fallen off a shirt.
Right.
Since it didn't match any of Julie's clothes, the simple conclusion is that the button belonged to whoever killed her, especially, you know, because there was blood on it. Investigators went to both John and Brenda, and both of them denied owning an Eddie Bauer shirt. And then they questioned Holly. Holly had said that Overstreet was missing a shirt, and she admitted that she had purchased Overstreet a few shirts from an outlet in Gilroy. One of these shirts was a green and blue checked button-down Eddie Bauer shirt. Holly was escorted to the stores by the police, and she went and found the exact shirt she had purchased, because I think she had, like, just recently bought these shirts for him, so they were still available in the store. The buttons were an exact match.
Not looking good for Overstreet.
Nope. Finally, they seemed to have some headway, and 7 days after the murder, Overstreet was tracked down from his credit card statement in Santa Clara, California, and arrested on his parole violation. He was brought back to Fresno for questioning. Overstreet admitted that he was at Julie's apartment that night, but he said he did not rape or murder her. He said that he was there because he wanted her advice on getting a car loan. Investigators immediately called baloney on this. I mean, Overstreet didn't have a job. He didn't have income. There was no way he was in the market for a car.
Yeah.
It didn't make sense to them.
That seems like a pretty common cop-out. Like, oh yeah, I was there, but I was there for a different reason.
A valid reason.
Yeah.
They also noticed that he had a cut on his hand and that it was healing into a scar. It was a pretty big cut and it was like on his knuckle. And it's widely known that during knife attacks, perpetrators often cut themselves. So, you know, this kind of healing wound, it would have been 7 days. So it would have definitely been a healed wound in the process of healing. So it definitely made the police question. Mary, Julie's mother, came forward and mentioned that on the night her daughter died, she had called her. When Julie picked up, she asked her mom if she could call her back because she was helping a neighbor.
Huh.
It seems to fit.
Seems so.
Still, investigators knew that they needed more evidence to prove that it was really Overstreet that did this. You know, anybody could have an Eddie Bauer shirt with buttons on it. It's a pretty popular company.
Right.
They had done all they could in Julie's apartment. There was no other evidence that they could find. So they headed over to Holly and Overstreet's apartment, which, you know, was obviously in the same complex. They noticed some brown marks on the bathroom door and cabinets. When tested, they were identified as blood. After DNA tests came back, they found that the blood belonged to two people. One came back as Holly's, which didn't really seem odd because her apartment, you know, it was in her own apartment and, yeah, you know, things happen.
Right.
And the second came back as Julie's. Then, just as the last nail was being put in his coffin, they found one of Julie's business cards in his wallet. They assumed he took it as a trophy of his violent attack.
Wow.
Julie had never been in the apartment, so this was really the evidence that they needed to convict Jeremy. Prosecutors believe that Jeremy had been out prowling for a victim. First, he tried with the apartment manager's wife, and then with the woman trying to get the sugar. Mm-hmm. And that's when
that was
he
the
kind
same
of.
Night?
It wasn't the same night, but it was within the same kind of time period. Gotcha. He hadn't lived in those apartments very long.
Right.
He was a kind of a new tenant.
Not even a tenant.
No. He's
just
living with Holly.
Yeah.
Yep. So he finally settled on Julie as his next victim. He knocked on her door and asked if she would mind talking to him about getting a car loan. Julie, being the kind and helpful person that she was, graciously let him into her home. Before the attack, Mary called, and that's when Julie mentioned that she had a neighbor over. At some point, the Forensic Files episode, you know, kind of insinuates it's while she's on the phone with her mom, but I'm not sure with that about that. Jeremy headed to the kitchen and grabbed a knife. They believe that the attack went similar to the one that he was convicted of in 1995, and that Jeremy gave Julie an ultimatum: either have sex with him or die. But Julie wasn't going to go down with a fight. She tried to run for the door, ripping Jeremy's button off his shirt in the process. Unfortunately, Jeremy was able to overpower her and proceeded to stab her 37 times. He then went to the kitchen sink to clean up a bit, leaving the knife in there, and then headed to his apartment where he finished cleaning up, accidentally splashing some of Julie's blood on the bathroom cabinet and door. On March 1st, 2003, 3 years after the murder, Jeremy was convicted of first-degree murder, attempted rape, and burglary. At sentencing, her son, Nathan, who was 12 at the time, had some powerful words, and Sean, I'd like you to read this. It's a long statement, but I think it's really powerful, and I think it's, you know, something that we should honor and say. So here it is. Sean, why don't you read that?
My name is John Nathan Michael Braun. I'm the son of Julie Braun. You murdered my mother. Why did you do it? What kind of a sick person are you? You sicken me. What did she ever do to you? She was trying to help, and you took advantage of her kindness. You're lucky you're not on death row. You took a life away. You should have to give your life for that. You're a liar. You did not need a car loan. You did not even have a job because you're a loser. You should have a big L on your forehead. My mom is in a better place now, a place you will never see. You're going to stay with the devil where you belong. You did not take her away from me, though, because she is in my heart and she is with me every day. She is with me forever. You only made my life miserable for a while, but your life is going to be miserable for eternity. Life has ended for you. You'll rot in hell. You'll rot in a hellhole where you belong. My life has not ended. It's only changed. I have my dad, I have another mom, and they take care of me and my three brothers and sister. They protect us from the evil. I have more grandparents, aunts, and uncles now too. I'm surrounded by love and happiness, something you never had. Who could love you? I bet your own mother never loved you. I'm going to make sure your life is miserable until the day you die. You're going to a bad place, and every day you're going to wish you were dead. But death is now too good for you. You need to see what it's like to be beaten, abused, and raped. You need a taste of your own medicine. I was only 9 when you killed my mom. My brother was only 3, and he doesn't remember much other than the pictures we have hanging in the house. I remember everything, and I remember all the good times we had together. But Christian, he will not remember her, but he has enough love around him, and we will get through this. This all happened because you couldn't get a girl unless you forced yourself on her, but you were too weak for my mom. She fought back because you disgusted her and couldn't handle it, so you had to cheat and get a knife to hurt her. Then you left because you thought you'd won, but you didn't. My mom won. She was able to leave clues for the police to get you caught. She was dead, and she still beat you. What a weak loser. Enjoy your stay in prison with all the other creeps, and I hope you enjoy your stay in hell with the devil.
I mean,
it's pretty intense for a 12-year-old, right?
Yeah, that is intense. And during the Forensic Files episode, he remembers the address, and he said that he felt sick just speaking to him, and that Overstreet was smirking at him the whole time.
Wow.
So, I mean, as a 12-year-old, having your mother murdered and then standing up in front of the murderer and saying that, I mean, that is a powerful, strong kid.
Yeah, I agree.
So Overstreet was sentenced to 2 life sentences with no chance of parole. Like he mentioned in the statement, he was not sentenced to death. But he was sentenced to 2 life sentences. Overstreet is in Salinas Valley State Prison, where he will sit for the rest of his life. Now, I kind of want to mention just a couple other things that I found interesting about this case that are absolutely not our opinions, but I just do think that it's interesting to mention. During the trial, the defense attorney mentioned that no other suspects were seriously looked at. And, you know, I kind of agree with this. Although Overstreet's MO was basically on point with what happened. So, I don't know if they, you know, this is exactly what he had done before. What are the chances that it would have been somebody else?
Right.
But that kind of leads until the next thing that I'm going to say. The footprints are never really spoken about again, and the knife didn't have any signs of blood, so I'm not sure that that was actually the murder weapon. I mean, there had to have been signs of blood on the knife if he killed him. He killed her with that exact knife. You know, right. I mean, he could have used a different knife. He could have brought his own knife. He could have thrown it somewhere. You know, who knows? He was gone for a week. He could have done anything.
Right.
And that's when I came kind of upon another theory. And this isn't like a real theory. This is just a theory that somebody commented in a blog. And the blog is called Catching Killers, and it will be linked in the show notes. And the commenters are kind of asking about Overstreet's girlfriend, Holly. They mentioned that Holly was the one that told investigators about Jeremy's missing shirt, and that it was Holly's blood mixed with Julie's, not Jeremy's blood mixed with Julie's.
I was going to say, that definitely sounded weird when it was her blood and Julie's.
Yeah. If he was indeed bleeding, there's no way he would have been able to get rid of all that blood and not mix it with hers when it's splashing around. It's not like you go and you get a cut and that it immediately stops bleeding. Like,
right.
It was a big cut. It would have continued to bleed. So I think that's definitely something interesting to note. Another thing is, what about the fact that when he came home, he walked right through the apartment that was, according to Forensic Files, kind of filled with people? Wouldn't people notice that he had a big cut on his hand?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's true.
You wouldn't be able to hide that. And none of them mentioned any blood on his shirt. And I know, like, when you're wearing a black shirt, it's hard to tell if there's blood on there. But this wasn't really a black shirt. I can see if I can find a picture of it and post it in the on Instagram. It's not a black shirt. And I feel like you might be able to see if there was blood on. I mean, he stabbed her 37 times. There would have had to be a lot of blood.
Definitely gotta be blood.
But there was no mention of that, and the shirt was never found. So they weren't able to really determine whether or not there was blood on that shirt.
Yeah.
But Holly said that she hadn't seen any blood on him. That doesn't mean that he wasn't able to change his shirt before he came back into the house. So I'm not sure. And then there's the fact that there was no sexual assault or rape of Julie. And it seems that his MO is rape.
Right.
So why wouldn't he have raped Julie? He seemed to be, you know, capable of doing it before. It could have completely just gotten out of hand and
Yeah, anger could have just taken over that she was fighting back and You just skip that step, maybe.
But what if Holly knew his motive?
So, yeah.
What if Holly knew that this is what he did and was able to put it on him? That would explain the lack of sexual assault. That would explain why, you know, the blood was mixed with hers in her apartment.
But then it gets into the, it's suspicious that he was gone unless...
Well, but he had the parole violation.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
He had a reason to run. But on the other hand, what kind of motivation would Holly have had to kill Julie?
Right.
There's no evidence that Julie and Overstreet had any more of a relationship than just meeting and talking on that one night. So I don't know about that theory. And I sincerely hope that it was Overstreet and, you know,
the right person is
behind. Yeah. The right person is behind bars.
Definitely some food for thought, though.
Yeah, it's a very interesting theory. And like I said before, I'm not even sure that her name is Holly. There's no other mention of her anywhere. And there isn't a lot of information on this case anyway. I found like maybe two or three articles, which I also found interesting. But yeah, that is this week's case. We hope that you enjoyed it. We will be back next week with another one.
See you guys then.
Yeah, see you guys then. Bye. We'll be right back.